All right, back on the Young Turks. I want to read you guys some comments. First from YouTube Super Chat. Patrick Seguin writes in, "Cenk, you rock." Well, thank you, Patrick. You're very nice for saying that. And Deadpool TY Interwebs writes, "Hashtag banana." Okay, but God bless your heart. Every time you use YouTube Super Chat, you do help the show. Daniel Button writes in, "Love your show, Turks. Never miss it." Again, thank you guys. Very, very nice of you. Appreciate it. Hissy Fit writes in on Twitter, hashtag TYT Live, to talk to us when the show is live, and that's 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern on tytnetwork.com or youtube.com/tyt. Hissy Fit writes in, "How come Rush Limbaugh doesn't have a warrant out on him? Isn't calling a hoax on hurricanes just like crying fire in a theater?" Look, I don't want to get into criminal investigations here, and he can say whatever he wants. Whatever you do, just don't listen to him. Blade Liger writes in, "I like this TYT going old school with rock music in the movie clips." Old Turk writes in about the last story I did in the conservatives with their 25 million views. He says, "25 million views, that's a good one." And then this is jumbled here, but somebody wrote in, "Kyle Kulinski is always kicking ass." Well, I agree with that as well, brothers and sisters. He's doing a great job. You should definitely check out Secular Talk. You should also check out shoptyt.com for this shirt. Resist with Rosa Parks, the original resistor. And then look at what Casper's got over there.
Yeah.
Kofefe. Every time I wear that shirt, I get comments. Every time. In fact, in the postgame today, I'm going to tell you more fun stories from my from jogging. When I go out jogging, what people say to me.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I was going to say, like, no one wants to hear about people's workout routines.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm not going to bore you. Okay. It's fun stories about what people shout at me.
Okay. All right.
TYTnetwork.com/join to become a member to hear the postgame. All right, Casper, what's up?
All right. Let me just fix my AFB. Okay. Got it. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos made an announcement today that did concern quite a few victims of rape and sexual assault. She is scrapping a memo sent out by the Education Department back in 2011 under the Obama administration, which essentially directed schools that receive federal funding on how to deal with accusations of campus sexual assault, harassment, and rape. Now, Betsy DeVos had hinted that she planned to do away with the directive, and she has done so today. First, I want to go to the video where she announces part of the reason why she made this decision. Take a look.
One rape is one too many. One assault is one too many. One aggressive act of harassment is one too many. One person denied due process is one too many. There is no way to avoid the devastating reality of campus sexual misconduct. Lives have been lost. Lives of victims and lives of the accused. And we're here today because the previous administration helped elevate this issue in American public life. But good intentions alone are not enough. Survivors, victims of a lack of due process, and campus administrators have all told me that the current approach does a disservice to everyone involved.
Break down what the approach was under the Obama administration. I'm sure some of you might have seen some coverage of this on other outlets, and none of them actually delve into the details of what the Obama administration called for. And, you know, Betsy DeVos makes some pretty heavy allegations against it, indicating that the definition for sexual assault was too broad. No, it wasn't. It was actually pretty specific. Now, it's not to say that it didn't have some problems, and we will get to those problems in just a second. But I want to be clear about one thing. Betsy DeVos is coming from a place of, hey, you know what? We're being really unfair to those who are accused. Okay, so she is essentially turning the accused into the victims here. When in reality, the biggest problem that led to the Obama administration putting out that directive was the fact that in many cases, universities and college campuses refused to do a proper investigation or investigation at all when a student accused another of sexual assault or rape. So that was when the federal government got involved.
So important context here. When she says the rights of the victims and the accused have to be balanced, That's not a controversial statement. Should the accused have rights? Of course, it's America. Of course they should have rights. The question is, what do you emphasize? When the overwhelming majority of the cases turn out to be true, and you then start calling it 50-50, I'm not sure you've got your priorities straight. It's not to say that the accused shouldn't have rights. Of course they should. But once you give them rights and it turns out they are guilty, and you treat it as if it's a 50-50 situation when the stats don't bear that out, that's a huge problem. The second problem is that the colleges and universities have an incentive to cover this stuff up because it makes them look bad, which then affects the people that apply, the people that come, and it affects their funding. So that goes to the core of what they care about. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't acknowledge that at all. In fact, it takes the thing that acknowledged it and said, hey, don't brush this under the rug. Make sure you're treating it proportionally and in a truly and correctly balanced way, and says, no, let's scrap that. Let's not do that at all.
Right. So let me be absolutely clear about one thing. Obama's directive, or the Education Department's directive under the Obama administration, made clear that the investigation did have to be impartial. So what you just said
about,
yeah, so she makes it seem as though the Education Department under Obama came out and said, no, as soon as someone's accused, they're guilty, that's it. No, it said,
that's ridiculous.
Hey, you need to investigate it, okay? You need to be impartial as you do this investigation. And look, there is a different burden of proof when it comes to a criminal case. So if this alleged rape, for instance, goes to trial and it is a criminal case, the burden of proof is much higher. That person needs to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, because that is a serious allegation and you're talking about a criminal offense. When it comes to a college campus though, they're not lawyers, there's no judge, this is not a criminal system. This is a university making a decision as to whether or not this rape happened, and if it did happen, has it created a hostile environment that distracts the victim from learning and feeling comfortable on campus, and then the university decides what it should do. But again, the burden of proof is a little lower for the universities because we're not talking about a criminal case, we're talking about a university in doing their own investigation to figure out what's best for those involved.
All right, one more piece of context, because if you're saying, aha, I knew it, it's a lower burden of proof, that's their railroading these guys. It should always be an incredibly high burden of proof. No, there's different contexts. For example, civil trials. Civil trials don't require you to be 98% certain, 99% certain. They just require you to be 51% certain, because you've got to decide who's right, who's wrong. So you might or might not remember this. So OJ, of course, got acquitted. Everybody remembers that in his criminal trial. But then the Goldman family, who lost their son, sued OJ in a civil trial. And they won, and they won easily, because it was a different burden of proof, because he likely did it. It's just in the criminal trial, they couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right, so again.
So in some context, it makes perfect sense to have a different burden of proof, because they're not lawyers and justices and judges at the university, and they've got to make a decision, who's right, who's wrong, how do we make sure there's the least amount of damage here?
Right, and again, these are school officials who do not have the power to convict someone of a felony, which is why the burden of proof is lower. And by the way, the burden of proof is still very high, because they have to, through their investigation, find that the person who has been accused more than likely did it. Okay, so again, it's a lower burden of proof, but they have to provide evidence indicating that this individual more than likely did it.
I'm just gonna say one last thing, because these right, like you might be hearing right wing propaganda out there, and they make it seem like, all you have to say is, he did it, and then they kick you out of college. It's not remotely true. They go through an entire long process, because nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to take a kid who didn't do it and go, I don't know, somebody said it, so what, let's just throw it out. By the way, on this show, we've defended many people who we thought didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And there was big debates about the mattress woman at Columbia, and I think she was preposterous, and I don't want to get back into those debates. Of course, as progressives, we value the rights of the accused. But you also have to make sure that you're protecting the women on campus and men if they're being sexually assaulted.
Right, and there is a percentage of men who do face sexual assault on campus as well. So this isn't just a female victim issue. Now, back to DeVos, I want to go to graphic three to give you a better sense of where she stands on this. She says that those that use a system bias toward finding a student responsible for sexual misconduct are also committing discrimination. DeVos suggests that the definition of sexual assault is too broad and too many cases involve student and faculty simply for speaking their minds or teaching their classes. That is patently untrue. And again, I'm gonna reiterate, if you've seen coverage of this story anywhere else, they never get to the details of what that directive said. So it was 20 pages long. I wanted to make sure I read every word to really understand it and give you guys the facts. So let's get to that.
Okay, sorry, one last thing there, because that statement shows you what DeVos is about. Because when she says, let's be balanced, that there's no harm in saying that, of course you should be. But when she says that you could be accused for just saying words, that's just not true. That shows you she has bad intent. She's purposely lying about what the policy says. Look, I was a conservative when I was on college campuses, and I remember one time somebody said that I should not be allowed to speak in class because I was such a large man that my words intimidated them. Okay, so I fought that nonsense. And by the way, you know what the liberal dean said at the college? That's nonsense. Of course you're allowed to speak. Doesn't matter how large you are. I mean, how preposterous. We're never gonna agree to stuff like that, but that's not what the policy does. DeVos is lying about it.
Now, here are the relevant portions of the memo sent out by the education department back in 2011. Now, they did define sexual violence rather specifically. They said sexual violence, as that term is used in this letter, refers to physical sexual acts perpetrated against a person's will or where a person is incapable of giving consent due to the victim's use of drugs or alcohol. An individual also may be unable to give consent due to an intellectual or other disability. So that is what we're talking about there. And I don't know, I mean, I don't consider myself that smart, but I understood the specific definition laid before me that describes exactly what the sexual violence is and what the university is expected to investigate should a complaint come forward.
Now, you know, maybe she's twisting it on purpose. Well, if the woman says no and you rape her anyway, and then they say, well, I mean, what are you just punishing the guy for language just because she said no, he was supposed to stop? Is that the point of her mentioning language? Come on, man.
So let me give you
more.
They
have bad intent, they really do. Sorry, go ahead.
So what did this letter tell universities that receive federal funding? What did they tell them they need to do? Okay, so they laid it out, here are the bullet points. Disseminate a notice of non-discrimination. Essentially, let everyone on that campus know we're not gonna discriminate against you based on your gender, your sexual orientation. That is standard Title IX requirements. So there's nothing controversial about that. Designate at least one employee to coordinate its efforts to comply with and carry out its responsibilities under Title IX. So just hire one person who actually carries out the responsibilities of Title IX, one person.
Well, if you're gonna change that, I know you're not gonna go up. The only other number is zero. So is that a balanced approach? Ridiculous.
Adopt and publish grievance procedures providing for prompt and equitable, I'm gonna repeat that again, equitable resolution of student and employee sex discrimination complaints. Okay, so where is this like overburdensome for universities? Because again, the reason why this letter was sent out by the Department of Education was because there was an increasing number of women coming forward and alleging that their universities refused to even investigate it. And so what the education department said was, hey, look, we want you guys to do a thorough and prompt investigation and find a solution or resolution, okay? You have to do that because you don't want to create an environment where students don't feel safe. Now, here's another thing that I want to read to you. And again, this is exact wording from the letter that was sent out. The school's inquiry must in all cases be prompt, thorough, and impartial. In cases involving potential criminal conduct, school personnel must determine, consistent with state and local law, whether appropriate law enforcement or other authorities should be notified. Oh, this is just, I mean, look, it's just, they're going to find people guilty immediately as soon as they're accused. That's what this letter was all about.
Anna, Obama administration, by demanding impartiality, obviously meant be biased.
No, but here's the thing, okay? This administration, this current administration, just wants to undo anything that Obama did, right? It doesn't matter if the Obama administration had executive orders or passed or pushed for legislation that made sense and actually made people's lives a little better. Doesn't matter if it's climate change, doesn't matter if it has to do with sexual assault on college campuses, doesn't matter if it has to do with the LGBT community being allowed to join our military. Doesn't matter how much sense those policies made. The Trump administration hates the Obama administration so much that they just want to undo anything that he did with no rhyme or reason.
Besides, no, but Anna, to be fair to them, they're also right wingers and they believe this stuff. They think sexual assault, the balanced approach to that is maybe having zero people look into it instead of having one person looking into it. And so, you know, you say tomato, I say tomato. You say it was sexual assault because she said no. I say, well, are you really being fair to the guy? So, and Betsy DeVos looks pleasant and she went to her nomination hearings and was like, oh no, I'll be so fair. Ben Carson did the same thing. Gorsuch did it for the Supreme Court. And the press talked about how pleasant they looked and the pleasant words that they said. It doesn't change what their policies are. Their policies are oftentimes barbaric. And so the minute they have an opportunity to implement it, they're going to implement it. And so then don't vote for Republicans if you are going to send your daughters to college and you're worried, or your sons, and you're worried what might happen. So, and don't get surprised when they do, because this is what they believe in.
It's pretty sad. Anyway, so what is expected to happen moving forward? The current education department would like some public opinion on how universities should handle it, and they of course want to get the thoughts and opinions of individuals who have been against this letter that was sent out by the education department. We'll see how it goes, but it's not looking good.
Now, they don't care about public opinion. They'll take a bunch of right-wing trolls' comments and go, see, we knew it. We knew it. The poor accused, there's no, this issue of sexual assault is overhyped and yada, yada. So that's just an excuse for doing whatever they want.
All right, let's take a really quick break. When we come back, we'll dive right into Facebook selling ads to Russian troll farms. Apparently, there's some evidence of that now. So stick around, we'll give you that and more.
All right, guys, back on the Young Turks. I'm having a little bit of trouble with my Twitter machine here, so I've only got one that I could read clearly. Jessica Allison writes, and if the Obama administration had found a cure for cancer, Trump would ban the medicine in the US. That's how petty he is.
I would not be surprised.
Agreed. All right, that's all I got for you guys. Sorry, I wish I had more. Anyways, we do have amazing stories. Go forward, Casper, go.
All right. The special counsel's investigation into possible Russian collusion by the Trump administration continues. And through this investigation, we're finding more and more interesting tidbits about what happened during this past election, information that was unraveled by our intelligence communities. And now we have even more elaborate detail into just how far Russia went in order to play a role in our elections. Now, recently, Facebook let investigators know that through their own investigation into their ad sales, they found that they had sold ads to individuals who were basically working for the Internet Research Agency. That is a Russian troll farm. These are individuals who purposely put out fake information or propaganda in order to lead to divisiveness and negativity and other things that could potentially sway some of the more vulnerable undecided voters out there. So representatives of Facebook told congressional investigators Wednesday that the social network has discovered that it sold ads during the US presidential campaign to this shadowy Russian company seeking to target voters. They traced the ad sales totaling $100,000 to a Russian troll farm with a history of pushing pro-Kremlin propaganda. So there were about 3,300 ads that had digital footprints that led to this particular Russian company. Again, the Internet Research Agency. Now,
can I just say real quick that ex-employees of that particular company have come out and said, yes, we definitely push pro-Kremlin propaganda in other instances. And this is quotes from earlier, because this story about Facebook just broke, obviously. And so, for example, Boris Nemtsov, who was a Putin critic, was murdered in 2015. And this same company immediately started doing personal attacks on his character after he was killed. Gee, I wonder if the Russian government killed him. I can't quite tell. Mm-hmm. But this is what they do. After they kill someone, they smear him. Unfortunately, sometimes we see that here in America as well. But they then turn their trolling to outside of Russia, and in this case, to our elections.
To our elections. So the earliest instance that Facebook found was back in 2015, when the election season started to really ramp up. And at that point, the ads that were put out there, the content that was put out there by this Russian troll farm, focused specifically on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Although Facebook is refusing to identify which candidate these trolls were endorsing.
You know which one it was. Everybody knows it. Hey, look, if it turns out Facebook says later, hey, you know what, they were actually supporting Hillary Clinton, that would be amazing, and we would report that, and we would go, wow, we didn't see that coming.
Right.
And that's also terrible, by the way, if they are supporting Hillary Clinton. We don't want any meddling of the elections, no matter whose side they were on.
Right.
But you know, in reality, of course it was for Donald Trump.
So here's what else Facebook found through their own investigation. Their teams discovered 470 suspicious and likely fraudulent Facebook accounts and pages that it believes operated out of Russia, had links to the company, and were involved in promoting the ads. Now, although they declined to say which candidate the ads favored, now most of the ads appear to focus on amplifying divisive social and political messages across the ideological spectrum, touching on topics from LGBT matters, to race issues, to immigration, to gun rights.
I want to pause here because that's super important. Guys, you got to be careful about what's going on the internet, because there are troll farms out there and their whole job is to divide us. So mission number one for Russia was create, sow division inside the United States, cause chaos. Mission number two was, can you imagine if Trump got elected? That would be amazing, since he owes us all that money and we have compromata on him. Now, that part is my speculation, backed up by overwhelming circumstantial evidence that's already public.
Right.
I think that they probably, like a lot of other people, thought it was a long shot, but their ads did go towards, very likely, and based on what we know already, went towards Donald Trump and attacking Hillary Clinton, but not exclusively. New York Times did a story about 6 months ago that there was another troll farm out of Macedonia, and they were trying to divide the Democrats. Now, again, that helps Trump and the Republicans, but the way that they were dividing Democrats were by posing as Bernie bros, who would then say sexist and outrageous stuff to other Democrats, so that the Hillary Clinton team could then go, you see that? You shouldn't trust any of the Bernie people. Here are these Bernie bros saying sexist things. It turns out it was the Russians.
Right.
That's amazing. That's a New York Times story. This one is a Washington Post story. So when you see people that go on these hot button issues and try to provoke you, calm down. It might be a troll in Eastern Europe, and don't buy into that. Now, when you see actual human beings on TV dividing you, that's real. Okay. And so that's a different category. But they want us to be at each other's throats on social media. So don't help them do that.
Don't help them do that. And it's incredible how much it worked, because I'm sure we all experienced it, where you see an article that has outlandish allegations and claims, and people will buy into it, and then people engage into debates as to whether or not it's real, whether it's Hillary Clinton having a terminal illness or Seth Rich allegedly getting murdered by someone in the DNC or Pizzagate. Like, all sorts of nonsense kept popping up on Facebook. And, you know, I don't know if those specific conspiracies and those specific fake news stories came specifically from these Russian troll farms, but that's the kind of stuff that you saw on social media. And when you consider the fact that a lot of people get their information from what's shared on social media, it's concerning. Now, the next
step— Can I just say on that issue, because I took a lot of heat from folks when I said Hillary Clinton was not terminally ill. Well, I'm waiting for your apology, because she hasn't died yet. You were convinced that she has some sort of brain tumor or something like that. And
but
by the way,
she was coughing a lot, like how
and by the
we
way,
do on the show.
A lot of it, some of it was you guys meaning generally some tiny sliver of the audience, right? And some of it was the trolls who were like, oh, jank or whatever, right? And then CNN, etc., whoever they directed to, oh, you're just shilling for her when she obviously is mentally disabled. I'm like, I've seen the debates. There is someone mentally disabled in the debates, and it isn't Hillary Clinton. Okay, so and it goes with the conspiracy theories on the right as well, where they're like, oh, Obama's going to do the FEMA camps. He left office. There was no FEMA camps. I'm still waiting for the apology. So anyway, and some of it helped Hillary Clinton, and they used that to say, aha, here's a Twitter account who no one can trace that says something sexist and pretended to be for Bernie Sanders. And the Clinton machine loved that. And they would purposely pick that up and go, you see that? Everybody who's in favor of the most liberal senator in the country is sexist and racist. They use it for their own purposes. So there was a lot of bad intent on a lot of sides here.
Absolutely. One other thing that I wanted to bring up is now that we have this information, it's up to investigators to figure out whether or not this is something that the Russian troll farm did on its own with the influence of the Kremlin, or if there was some potential possible involvement by the Trump camp, whether or not the Trump camp directed individuals to do what they did with these Facebook ads. So the investigation continues. Again, it's a very slow and steady drip of information that we're getting. But considering the fact that in November, Mark Zuckerberg completely denied that there was a fake news problem on Facebook, it's interesting to see how far they've come in kind of accepting what's really going on.
Now, there's a ton of connections between Donald Trump and the Russian government during the campaign and way before the campaign, but to be fair, there is no smoking gun yet on this issue of did the Trump campaign know about the troll farms. I have not seen evidence of that yet, and Facebook has not presented evidence of that yet. So I just want to be fair and clear on that. Why are we suspicious of them? I mean, there's
They lied about the meeting that they had with those Russian like officials.
And a thousand other things.
Yeah.
Donald Trump Jr. just came out and said, oh, I met with the Russian lawyers, and I know in the email I said I love it that they were going to give me information about Hillary Clinton from a foreign source I'm not supposed to get it from. I didn't mean I love it that I'm going to get that illegal information. I meant that I love it that they were setting up the meeting. It was such a nice thing for them to do. I wasn't trying to get bad information about Hillary Clinton. I was just trying to make sure she was fit for office, wanted to make sure she was okay. Oh, come on, does anybody believe that? Even if you're a right winger, you can't believe that. Come on. So they obviously did want to work with the Russians in some ways. Whether they actually worked with them in this way is yet to be determined.
Exactly. All right, let's switch gears to other news. Kentucky currently has one abortion clinic where women can have their reproductive rights and carry out an abortion should they choose to not go through with a pregnancy. However, lawmakers in Kentucky are fighting rather aggressively to shut that last abortion clinic down. And the way that they plan on doing so is by using and enforcing a law that forces them to have hospital admitting privileges. Now, there are many red states that have tried to implement a similar policy. Courts have already ruled on this policy, but nonetheless, the right wing continues to fight on with these ridiculous arguments. Now, hospital admitting privileges essentially make the claim that, well, this abortion clinic needs to make sure that if anything goes wrong with this abortion, they have the ability to send this individual that they're treating to a hospital. Now, the problem with that is in most red states, a lot of these hospitals refuse to give admitting privileges to the clinics because the hospitals themselves have some religious slant and feel like it's against their morals to do so. But in this case, the abortion clinic did have hospital admitting privileges. It just was considered insufficient by the governor of Kentucky. Now, earlier this year, Kentucky's Cabinet for Health and Family Services sent the clinic a letter informing the clinic that it was out of compliance with state regulations that require clinics to have standing agreements with local hospitals and ambulance services to transfer patients in case of medical emergencies. Lawyers, though, for EMW, which is the clinic that stands, the only clinic in Kentucky, argue that the state is attempting to enforce baseless regulations, pointing to the 2016 Supreme Court ruling in Whole Women's Health v. Hellerstedt. That ruling found that Texas, which had required abortion clinics to have surgical center level facilities and abortion providers to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, constituted an undue burden on women seeking abortions.
So let me begin to break that down. So first of all, I thought Republicans were against burdensome regulations. Turns out they love burdensome regulations when it suits their purposes. I thought they were for small government. Turns out they love big government with all of its regulations, again, between you and your doctor. Okay, so you're not surprised by that. Second of all, that is a very conservative Supreme Court in 2016 saying, look, it is unconstitutional to interfere with a woman's right to an abortion. And the state of Texas clearly impose an undue burden that interfered with their right to choose based on nonsense, burdensome regulations that said, oh, you have to follow this procedure and that procedure with nearby hospitals. And you know why you're doing that. And the conservative Supreme Court said, you're not tricking anyone. We know you're trying to limit abortions, and these are not actual necessary regulations. Again, enjoy that irony that even a conservative Supreme Court says it's Republicans who are for burdensome, unnecessary regulations. Now, nonetheless, Kentucky says, I don't care. I'm going to pass the same exact law, even though it got declared unconstitutional a year ago.
Right, right.
Okay. And then on top of that, it turns out, no, this clinic was actually following the rules of Kentucky and did have relationships with those hospitals exactly like they were supposed to, and they've had them for years and years and years. And Matt Bevin comes in and he's like, yeah, I don't like the law. I'm like Trump, he doesn't like the law, Sheriff Joe doesn't like the law. So when we don't like the law, we just violate it. So he's like, the regulations that we previously said were sufficient, I'm just gonna say now they are quote unquote deficient. So voila, I just did an executive order in a sense at the state level saying that I'm going to impose further regulations on you, and there's no way you can meet them because it's my judgment call.
Right, so they make it increasingly difficult for these clinics to be able to meet the regulations. And as soon as they do meet the regulations, they'll make the regulations even more stringent, even more impossible to follow through with.
But in this case, they did meet the regulations.
Right.
Bevin comes in and goes, that's like your opinion, man. I say you didn't meet the regulations, so how can I meet them?
And
I'm not gonna tell you.
It shows you how disingenuous they are, right? Because they don't actually think that these procedures are so dangerous that they need to have these very specific hospital admitting privileges in case of an emergency. No, they just wanna make it as difficult as possible for this one abortion clinic to remain standing. And so a federal judge had already ruled on this and said, okay, you're not allowed to shut down this clinic while this case is pending. And so a federal court will make a decision on this legislation soon. But the thing that I want to bring up is it is a huge waste of taxpayer money in the state of Kentucky. Because again, the Supreme Court has already ruled on this. And so, okay, you're going to go to a federal court, you're going to spend taxpayer money to fight this. And in the end, you know, if justice plays out the way that it's supposed to, it will be found as an undue burden and the clinic will not shut down.
And Matt Bevin, stop lying. So we know you're pro-life and you admit you're pro-life. and just say, I want to overturn Roe versus Wade. I know this is an illegal law. I know it's an unconstitutional law, but I want to do it anyway, just because every single year I want to go to the Supreme Court and try again and again. But you're not being honest about it. Instead, you're now saying you're a champion of burdensome regulations.
That's right.
Okay, and it's a lie. And your Republican constituents know it's a lie too. So, okay, great. Matt Bevin for further government regulations.
Also, I just wanted to quickly note that yesterday Cenk did a story about a right winger who wrote a column in the New York Post, I believe, about how we should nuke North Korea because fuck them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
A conservative said that. Let's nuke North Korea and kill all of these innocent individuals, preemptively, by the way. And this is the same group of people that think, oh, we're pro-life. We can't let women have abortions because you're killing people. You can't kill babies. What do you think you're gonna do when you nuke North Korea? They're just, it's
you know
lie.
What, Anna, that's such
Look, real quick, let me just finish my point, because I say this every time we do stories involving reproductive rights. There are definitely Christians out there or conservatives out there in the country who genuinely do believe it's life at the moment of conception, okay? And they live their lives the way that they feel is fit, the way that they feel is moral, but they're usually not the ones that are like, you know, pounding their chests talking about how they have to do away with reproductive rights. The ones who do pound their chests and talk about how they need to do away with reproductive rights, those are individuals who don't really care about life because their policies and what they really push for reveals what they really care about. They just want to control women. They hate that women have the ability to decide their own destiny. They hate that women have the ability to take birth control and decide when they become mothers, if they become mothers. It takes power away from incredibly insecure, pathetic men. And Matt Bevin falls right under that category.
Okay, you made such a great point there, and one I hadn't thought of before. The person you're referring to is Ralph Peters. He's a so-called security analyst for Fox News and writes for the New York Post. And he wrote, better a million dead North Koreans than we take any chances with any American lives. So, and he argued for a preemptive strike where we would kill millions of innocent civilians. Now, what I hadn't considered, Anna, is not only are there babies, women, children, men, grandmothers, grandfathers that would be incinerated alive in a nuclear strike, there would also be fetuses. So you would actually be in favor of mass abortions, because when you detonate a nuke and millions of people die, that is probably, you know, in the neighborhood of hundreds of fetuses who you consider life, that's apparently the only life you care about.
That's right.
That would also be incinerated. So I guess Ralph Peters, Rupert Murdoch, who owns the New York Post, and all those right wingers who argue for that position are not at all pro-life. They hate the pro-life position. Just be honest with who you are.
Yep. All right, let's move on to somewhat lighter news. Let's do a little international news. Japan's population continues to shrink, and part of the reason why is because the birth rate in the country is incredibly low, and that is a problem that we've brought up and talked about on the show quite a bit. However, it is having a real negative impact on the economy in Japan. The workforce needs more workers, and even though there is a problem with the population shrinking, there's also the issue of foreign workers. Japan doesn't have a lot of foreign workers, and so as a result, owners of companies are trying to think of creative ways to get people who don't typically work back into the workforce. And they're focusing specifically on housewives. So there are a lot of convenience store chains or fast food restaurants that are now trying to like engage with housewives, and they're trying to convince them to come back into the workforce and go through some training just so they can have enough people to run their companies. Now, McDonald's Japan announced it is beginning a 2-month recruitment drive targeted at housewives under a slogan that roughly translates as McDonald's, no problem, promising new hires both flexibility and good growth prospects. So,
can I just say that's a terrible slogan? McDonald's, no problem.
I know.
Why? Was there a problem?
But they're translating it from Japan, Japanese. So okay. I'm sure it means like, yeah, I know it's a pain in the ass to work, but don't worry, we'll be flexible. You know what I'm saying?
Okay,
right?
Maybe that's a better translation.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So housewives, one executive at McDonald's says housewives are a valued labor force because they are very hospitable and are very conscious of cleanliness in our restaurants.
I'm glad there's no stereotypes involved, though.
Yeah, look, in Japan, the pay gap is actually pretty bad. Okay, it is the second worst country in terms of a gender pay gap.
So among economically developed countries.
Among economically, obviously, yes. But you know, that probably speaks to why that type of comment is openly made and yeah, people don't criticize it, you know?
Yep, no yeah, question. South Korea, by the way, is the worst in disparity. But to be fair to the Japanese, their female participation rate in the economy is higher than ours.
Yes.
So more women work in Japan than they do in the United States.
That's kind of bananas.
That's amazing, yes.
Yeah, so also keep in mind that the percentage of housewives in the workforce in Japan is about 20%. The percentage of Japanese women in the workforce experienced a sharp drop once women enter their 30s, from 80% at age 29 to just over 71% from the ages of 30 to 39. So as they get older and they have kids, they're less likely to be in the workforce. However, the leader of Japan is trying to change that by making childcare more available, by encouraging women to go out there into the workforce after they have kids. And again, Japan's female labor market participation rate has surpassed that of the United States and is no longer low compared to other advanced countries.
And finally, again, to stay on giving them credit, it's Shinzo Abe's plan here did work and it brought more women back into the labor workforce with a very simple idea, as Anna pointed out. They got kids, especially the older women who then want to get back into the workforce after initially having kids. So you got to give them child services. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, it turns out they want to work. But here in America, we're like, oh no, you can barely take any time off and it might not be paid at all if you have kids right in the beginning. And then later, childcare, we're not going to give you any stinking childcare. Here's some bootstraps. So it turns out if you do childcare, more women will work. Makes sense.
More women will work. And look, Abe saw that as an economic solution. Whereas here in the United States, it's not seen as an economic solution. It is. It absolutely is. If you want more women to go out there and to not feel burdened by the costs of childcare, you want them to be part of the economy, to be productive. By the way, people who stay home and take care of their kids are also productive, but I mean economically productive specifically. If you want it to happen, you need to make it a little easier on them. We don't have mandatory maternity or paternity leave, and we also can't afford, most of us can't afford how expensive childcare is right now. It's yep, so crazy expensive. Like, how do people do it? Like, what if you have kids, what do you do?
In the big cities, it's just insane. It's,
if you don't,
and if
have,
you don't
like,
live by
family?
Your parents and family, you're totally screwed. And the government's not gonna help you, nobody's gonna help you. And see, gee, I wonder why the younger generation thinks a mixed economy is not such a bad idea.
Exactly.
All right, what's next?
All right, the story that I've been dying to get to. A woman threw her own feces outside of a window during a debate. Not a debate.
Now that's an awesome Freudian slip. Okay, in a debate with Bernie Sanders. No, okay, that's not right. No, okay. I denounce and reject ourselves. Okay.
A woman threw her own feces outside of a window during a date, and after that feces got stuck somehow near the windowsill, she tried to get it out and then got stuck in said windowsill, which made it the awesome, worst date of all time. Now, this story is amazing, and I don't know how it made it to the headlines. I don't know how BBC got this story, but it is one of my favorite stories ever. It starts with a Tinder date, okay? This couple gets together, they have dinner, they're having a good time, right? And then they decide, let's go back to the apartment, have some wine, have some more fun, right?
Don't it.
Now, in the middle of this wine drinking and fun having, the woman in question realizes that she needs to use the potty. And so she goes to the bathroom, does number two, and panics when she realizes that the toilet's not flushing.
Not her fault. That seems to be the guy's fault. You gotta maintain your toilets.
Now, you can't leave, you know, feces in the toilet. Like, that's embarrassing. It's a first date. So she decides to somehow reach in, grab it, and try to throw it out the window.
Because that is less embarrassing.
Oh, that is. No, but like, I don't know what, I mean, what do you do? What do you do? Like,
no, leave it there?
You can't leave it there.
No, you can, because it's the least bad option.
Okay.
I know we're not voting for lesser of two evils, but you can't scoop it out. You just got to say, hey, dude, your toilet doesn't work. That's a disaster, but anyways.
Well, at least we know that she has a healthy diet, because that was a solid poo, right? What if it wasn't solid? Then what is she going to do? She has no options then. Okay, so she throws it out the window. It somehow gets stuck. And then she panics because it's easy to see it, where it got stuck. And so she felt like she needed to be honest with the man that she was on a date with. His name is Liam Smith. So she goes back into the room and she's like, yo, I threw my poop out the window, it's stuck.
Yo, we need she's British. Anyway,
yo.
I do declare, I pooped in your bathroom, then I reached in, scooped it up, and I figured out who number two works for.
Quite a controversy. So then they get together and try to figure out how they can retrieve the poo that has now been stuck near the window. All right, now let me give you the details as written by the New York Daily News. Now, let's go to graphic 24. His date was able to, let's go to graphic 23. The window the woman used opened into a gap that was separated by another window, which is where the poop was stuck. Mm. Smith said he left the bathroom to get a hammer to smash the window, but his date decided to try to climb through and got trapped. Yeah. So at this point, you know, Liam Smith knows what's going on. He's like, okay, we need to retrieve the poo. Let me go get a hammer and break the window. And so as he was doing that, she's like, no, I'm taking matters into my own hands, which apparently is a really bad idea for her to ever do. Tries to go through and then she gets stuck. And at that point, they gotta call the authorities. So they call the authorities and, you know, nightmare. They luckily rescued her. We have pictures of the incident, graphics 26 and 27. There's the woman in question.
Oh my God, as if it wasn't bad enough. Like, I'm stuck, and I'm right next to the poo.
Please,
someone help me. Oh my God, is that her feet up in the ceiling?
Yes. How did this happen?
Oh, how did she do that?
I don't know.
I just cannot understand how this story could get any more disastrous.
Like, okay, here's the thing. You threw the poo out the window because you didn't want to be embarrassed in front of a man that you're on a date with. But then you proceeded to get embarrassed with several men on the scene. Like, let's go back to that picture. Oh, it's terrible. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Okay, so this whole incident destroyed his window. And he's a struggling postgraduate student. And he's like, I need money to fix this window. So what he did was he started like a crowdfunding page and he was hoping to get $300. He ended up getting like $1,200. Euros, let me be specific, euros. So he got 1,200 euros. He and his date got together and donated what they didn't need to charity. So they're great. And guess what? He really liked her. So they're going out on another date.
Oh, man, you better fix that toilet, son. There's so many amazing parts of this story. And the twist at the end is even better.
Yeah.
He's like, who gives him money for, because you know why? Because we're amused by the story and we're good people at heart. And with all the terrible things that happen on the internet, there's still wonderful things.
Yes.
And people look at that and go, God, I feel bad about the poo controversy.
What can poo do for you?
I barely get you 1,200 euros, which they then mainly give to charity. If they get married out of this, it is going to be one hell of a story to tell the kids.
I can't believe she reached for her poo and threw it out the window. That is amazing. This is my favorite story of the year.
Well, I guess we now know what happens when the poo hits the fan.
What a shitty situation.
Or at least the windows. Ay. I guess if it wasn't bad enough. All right, guys, we're out of time. We do have a great post game for you guys where I will tell you funny things people shout at me when I'm jogging. We do a lot of personal stories in the post game. TYTnetwork.com/join to get the post game, to get the whole 2-hour show commercial free. Listen to it anytime you want. And then, of course, Aggressive Progressive is also tonight. It's at 6 o'clock. Watch it live, 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern. Watch it live on TYTnetwork.com. And then get the whole show if you're a member as well. We'll see you in the postgame for members. Bye-bye.